Hello and welcome to No Directions 2017 Gen Con Seminar Coverage. Special thanks to our Gen Con volunteers, Eric Bring the Knives and Andrew Mullins. For more seminars and other great Pathfinder content, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.
This is Ask the Gems. Primarily, we're going to be answering any questions you have as GMs, players, otherwise. Probably for Pathfinder RPG and Starfinder RPG, but we can veer off course as well. Before we get into the questions, though, let's go ahead and just quickly get some introductions. My name is John Compton. I'm the Organized Play lead developer, so I work on Pathfinder Society, Starfinder Society, and the Pathfinder Adventure Card Guild.
And I'm Logan Bonner. I'm a designer at Paizo. I work on a lot of the hardcover books in the role-playing game line, so stuff like Ultimate Intrigue, Core Adventures, Bestiaries, that kind of thing.
And we run games. And answer questions for you. So, how can we start off? Yeah.
Okay, so, I've been running a solo druid through a bunch of homebrew adventures for like 5 years now. As is common with solo games, I've given the player a cohort to cover some of the weak spots, which is a witch. The problem is that I am better at building characters than my player is, and the cohort has now come to outshine the PC mechanically, particularly as regards knowledge checks. The player has she rolls more natural ones on knowledge checks than anyone else I have ever seen, which leads the witch cohort to say, oh, we need to go this way now. I don't quite know what to do about it, because the player doesn't like being outshone, but she also loves this character to the extent that she's been talking about getting a tattoo of the cohort in real life.
Well, you just say, if you have a tattoo of the cohort, you get a free reroll on the knowledge check once per session. And if you get a second tattoo of the cohort, that's two rerolls per session.
This is a dangerous path we travel, Logan.
I just need to figure out which tattoo artist to invest in.
So something you can... Having the cohort succeed at more knowledge checks is okay. Like, if you look at this from a video game design perspective, oftentimes there will be all the little secondary characters or the rest of the members of your party who will be the ones who chime in to provide all the setting lore to the player. And they can act as a window for the setting. So you could be using this cohort's success at knowledge skills to your storytelling advantage. So certainly that. I suppose
you can also kind of morph that success into a hint, mm-hmm. kind of in that same vein. Like if there are two pathways and the cohort succeeds on a knowledge check to know that's a pathway, they might be like, those gems in that wall look weird, don't they? And then the player can think, oh, right, they said take the purple path, and this has amethyst in the walls. And you can kind of filter it through something that's a little more subtle rather than just, I got a success, and it's this way.
And ultimately, leaving the agency in the player's hands is valuable. So similar to what Logan was saying, being able to have the player make the final choice, even not providing knowledge without the implication that there's a right and a wrong answer. It's like, well, this is the panel that will, you know, cover our hand in knives, and this is the panel that will give us a fruit cupcake. What do you think, boss? That's possible.
And you can also kind of, you know, take some of the sting out of failure. It's like, if they do choose the wrong way, then it's like, well, it delays you for a while because you go down a dead end, rather than saying, well, you went the wrong way and you fell in a pit and you died. Yeah, there's kind of levels of how extreme you go.
I think part of the problem is that oftentimes I feel like I have been taking agency away from her by steering things the way I have prepped for with the knowledge for skill results on the cohort. Mm-hmm. Maybe I need to set up a way for the cohort to do well on a knowledge check and get wrong information or fail in some way.
Yeah, it could also be kind of look at the outcomes of success and failure that you've kind of got planned and have something interesting in either path. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we succeed and we do the so-called correct thing, it's going to make it a little easier. If we fail, it's going to be more dangerous, but there's some kind of cool reward that we wouldn't have gotten if we went the other way or something like that. Or we get, so say, if we beat this enemy, then we get the map to their treasure hoard. And if we go the wrong way, we find their treasure hoard first, and it has something that might be useful against them, but it's also very dangerous. I'm also curious, when you're running the cohort, whether you do your roles publicly or behind the screen?
It's a virtual tabletop setup, and we've got, you know, buttons for all of these things, which are not secret. So the results are right there on the virtual tabletop for everyone to see.
Gotcha. Okay. Other questions?
Yes.
So this is more of an emotional thing. I have very young players. I often run for teens. And they'll get very invested in their character. And I tend to very much rely on consequences to make the story. This will tend to make players rather upset, and I have had players get to a point, even though I know I'm not picking on them, they've gotten to a point where they feel I'm picking on them, and they've gotten upset, and I don't know how to handle that as a GM.
Are these, when you say consequences drive the story, are you predetermining or pre-planning certain consequences?
No, but I found in my experience that GMs are a little bit more lenient on, say, like the third bad roll in a row. I'll go, no, you're unconscious for a day, or I'm not as combat focused as other players. This is a complaint, or as other GMs, this is a complaint I've gotten from many of my players that I'm not as combat focused.
Okay. So one thing that you could do to start to build up a willingness to explore other character options with them is you could have those consequences, as you mentioned, knock them out for an entire day or something like that, where they character A sure is bedridden for this next week.
Yeah.
Bring in character B, and by the end of it, they might be like, well, character A was pretty cool, but man, character B, so awesome, never going back to character A. and as you show them that, yes, they can have fun with multiple different character types, then they might be more willing to accept failure from a narrative perspective rather than seeing that, oh, all 40 sessions of my play experience have now been thrown down a goblin chipper.
And you can kind of say, make another character who is nothing like your primary character, right? So they can kind of get a contrast between them. And at some point they might want to be like, can this character take a break? Because this one's healed up now, and they'll kind of trade off and that kind of thing.
I like it.
And also, and you might already be doing this, but kind of if something is risky, really establish the risks beforehand so that if it's like, you can absolutely try that, it's very dangerous, and if it goes badly for you, you could be, and lay out straight up what the consequences are. And then at least when that happens, they aren't like, you just made that up to punish me. It's like, oh, well, I knew that could happen.
Yeah. So. No, I do fail in warning them of the risks, so that's something I could definitely work on.
Yeah, and it can be a tricky line to walk because you want to warn them, but you don't want them to become entirely risk-averse.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to show them the risk and the reward simultaneously. Could knock you out for a week. On the other hand, that golden chalice could be really sweet, and it might be magical.
Man, everyone loves character C because character C was the only one who rushed into the burning building to help any of the townspeople.
Yeah.
Could have died, but now he's Mr. Popular. Oh, next time that'll be me. Yes, sir.
To expand on what we're talking about here, you can turn failure into a door that opens into a new success. The example that I often use, I'm actually helping a young friend of mine. He's like 21 in college, and you know, he's learning how to DM. And I just graduated from college, so that's how I met him. But so I've been like advising this guy, and I actually use the example of Luke Skywalker in Empire Strikes Back. Lost a fight to a Wampa ice creature. And, you know, he wakes up hanging upside down, his lightsaber, you know, just out of reach. And he escapes. Getting out of that cave was a success.
Mm-hmm.
So you can turn that failure into a success. And, you know, add that much more excitement, that much more, you know, tension and dramatic.
Well, particularly in that instance, he also, he escaped by unlocking a new ability, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
He's using the Force, and this is the first time we've seen him really effectively do that in the series, right? So you can kind of say adversity has bred growth and kind of make something happen that way.
Yeah, I like that.
One of the tricky things you're probably going to run into, even if you're establishing risk and reward and that kind of thing, is the player who has taken the risk 4 times in a row and it paid off every time, and the player who's taken the risk 5 times in a row and failed every time.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the trickiest part, and it's kind of hard to do a lot to to ease that without kind of just kind of saying, well, I'm just going to take pity on you.
Get approached by the avatar of the god of failure, who's just like, I really like you, son. Let me give you some cleric levels.
I have had, say we're in combat, and any time in multiple combats, the creature has critted on this person every single time, and I'll get a crit again. I'm like, you're not getting crit. Die.
And I'm going to ask the same question I asked him, which is, do you roll your dice in the open?
Sometimes. It depends. Like, if it's a big battle, I'll roll it secretly. It also depends on the environment.
I would suggest if it's something like monsters attacking, I would roll your dice in the open all the time in those cases, just so you can be like, if you are playing directly by the dice, then it helps to give people that trust that you're not just trying to crit them.
Right. Yeah.
And you can kind of have that moment of, all right, I'm going to roll to confirm now. I need a 17.
You guys kill off your players, and if you don't kill off your players, do you feel it takes away from them?
Players or player characters?
Player characters.
Legally speaking, I feel like I should ask for... Yeah.
No, it's only interesting at the end of the night, they're slaughtered.
It depends on the format in which I'm playing. If I'm running a home game, then... I mean...
I absolutely will in a home game.
Yeah, whatever the format is, I want to make sure that the threat of death is there, even if the probability of death is not terribly high. In an organized play setting, I want to... I tend to not feel great when a character dies, unless they were, to put this as unvindictively as possible, asking for it. Like, there have been ones where they have just gone up and jabbed people in the eye 3 times in a row, and on the third one, I'm like, okay, town's going to turn on you now.
Yes, make a knowledge check. Yes, you know this is a master swordsman who can kill you in one single sword. Oh, okay.
I bet I can do it in half as many. What? I think that being able to kill off PCs is important. It should not be off the table.
And it depends a lot on context and you know how long you're going to play and how well you know the players. The better I know people, the more likely I am to be willing to kill their characters. Unless it's Eric Mona, in which case I know better than to kill his characters.
Then I kill them twice. Something along with that is, if you know your players fairly well, and you know, you might be able to make it so that character death is not just a thing that happened because of horrible accidents or horrible risk, but rather is a planned thing that you've planned out with that particular player, and might even be a surprise to the rest of the group. That worked out pretty well for me when I was a lot younger, and some of my players were like, I want to play a different character every 2 sessions. I'm like, okay, sure, but let's think of some creative way to do it. And at one point, he just wanted to be like, yes, I want my guy to turn into the villain. And so we sure did fight his character halfway through the session, and he was thrilled about it, positively thrilled. And then we watched him become a horrible, sticky mess on the pavement, but he was still thrilled. So you might be able to work out some deal with a character, with one of the players, to show and remind everybody else that death is a possibility, but it doesn't have to be the end of a good story.
And also, it can be tricky in Pathfinder particularly because it is a rules-dense game, and the amount of time you have put into creating your character and gearing up your character and everything can be really, you know, substantial. And it can also be like, yeah, your character fell down that pit and died, and oh, damn it, and all their gear went with them. No! So, and a lot of it is about turning death into the opportunity of what you bring next, right? And especially if you've gotten a ways into your campaign, then you can say, all right, the next character, we're going to have them really tied into the events that have happened so far. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good opportunity.
Behind?
Yeah. So I have a question about Pathfinder Society organized play. Do you have any plans on sort of rewarding more role play into the sessions? I see that a lot of the adventures don't reward role playing as much as a GM would like. What are thoughts on designing modules with roleplay baked in or encouraging players to roleplay as a GM?
We have several different, what I call, social scenarios. And those are very low combat. We also have plenty of scenarios that have a social scene in them, or a readily bypassed by social trickery, what have you, sort of thing. And many of those do remark, okay, for good role-playing, go ahead and give as much as a +5 bonus on this bluff check or diplomacy check, what have you. To an extent, that has to be the extent, because in an organized play format, there's not a good way to really support, oh, wow, I had somebody who's a great method actor at my table. I'm going to write on your chronicle sheet, you get a free wish. That's not part of how this works. But what I can do is I can say, you made a really clever argument. Like yesterday, there's one of our newer scenarios takes place in Kadira, and you're supposed to be impressing Kadiran people. There was a paladin of Serenray at the table. He apparently led the entire room in grace. And the GM was like, bam, we don't even need a diplomacy check. That's pretty cool to me. Yeah, so
yeah, the circumstance bonus and the automatic success are your friend.
Yeah. So those are the levels in which to take it, because with organized play, you really cannot carry that style of consequence too much further. But within the realm of a single scenario, you can play around with it a lot.
I, both in organized play and in my home games, have a situation where I have a lot of veteran, we've been playing this game for 20, 30 years players together, and then a lot of new players that we're trying to teach the game. How do you keep the meta game limited while it's also encouraging the new players to learn the system? How do you balance those two things where I get benefit from my older players teaching the system without it basically the one true option scenarios?
And this is beyond character build, this is also in the during play, right?
Build and play. And
during play, one of the finest things to really stymie and occasionally infuriate players like me who read all the things and are like, oh, it's one of these, oh, it's only CR11, we'll be fine, sorts of players, is to rename the hell out of stuff. Also to creatively and interpretively describe things. So when it's, oh, yeah, energy drain? Okay, well, it's a pain in the rear, but we know how that works. But if it's, oh, I rolled my knowledge religion check, what does this thing do? Oh, it tears off a piece of your immortal soul permanently, forever. Nobody even knows how it works. Then they're like, I need to boost everything. What do we even do here? Is that in the rulebook? What rulebook is that from? You're making things up?
Introducing uncertainty in general is a good way. And it kind of tricks people into getting into character.
And it levels the playing field for them. If you rename all of your creatures into either really obscure corner case similar analogs, or whether it's you made up your own name for orcs, that can confuse them, at least for a little while, until eventually everybody learns together what the capacity is for these things.
And if you're having a lot of trouble with, like, oh, no, you should do this. Oh, no, you don't want to do that, because if you take this path, you will get one extra 5 feet of movement, and then you can set up a flank. If you really are in dire straits, you can kind of say, if it's not your turn, you can't give advice.
Right. And for newer players, I've also found that I, as a GM, can steer it so that I am the one giving advice, and that means that I can then gently push aside the little Napoleon in the corner, and I can then present things in a much more open-ended options way. So it's like, okay, tell me in general what you want to accomplish.
Right.
Oh, well, then you want to... Here's how you might approach it.
Yeah, you can kind of start with the high concept of, I want to be able to attack that guy. And then you can kind of say, do you care if that guy smacks you? And if they say, yes, I care, then you'll have to cautiously approach by this route, and you won't be able to attack him until next turn. And then you can kind of turn the rules into something a little more friendly. And then you can then use that as a jumping off point to say, all right, okay, your turn's over. Can you explain to him what in the rules made them do that while I move to this person's turn?
And possibly the finest way of all of this is a shameless plug. It's the strategy guide. It's a great little companion to pass out to those newer players. Yes.
Back to the topic of the story consequences of death. One thing I've noticed in running longer running campaigns, particularly adventure paths, is that it's possible to wind up in a situation where there are no survivors from level one. That you have an entire group of people, like this one came in at level 3, and this one came in at level 7, and this one came in at level 8, and these three came in at level 9, and then you don't have anybody who's been there for the whole story. How do you deal with integrating people, new characters, into that story in a plausible way?
I have a couple ideas. One thing is a shared NPC. Somebody who's been sort of a mentor figure from the beginning or who otherwise knows the background, if there's not one of those, then suddenly those past characters, the ones that started level one, become the stuff of legend. It's like, oh gosh. And they're also further motivation. Like, we've been trying to track down and kill this evil wizard for ages. And by we, I mean our extended family of people with swords. And
our order.
And
it can help name the group or name the order or whatever so that they kind of all feel like part of a tradition.
They've slain all 7 of the founding members of our order, who are strong as 20 giants and could bend plate mail, whatever. You can start to play up the legend of these. And in addition to providing a little bit of uncertainty about the true founding lore of the campaign setting to the PCs, not necessarily the players, you can also kind of give a nice wink to those players in so much as their previous characters, the one who died while trying to bull rush a T-Rex off a cliff and met the invariable consequences. It suddenly is played up as some sort of heroic death, and they're like, you know, I don't feel so bad about that, because
to protect the 20 orphans from the T-Rex, they bravely charged out.
He bravely threw aside his great axe and tried to push.
Yeah.
You can have a lot of fun with that stuff.
Yeah, and you could have some new character comes in at 7th level, and one of the other characters says, okay, well, here's the journal, and they pull out a journal that's in, like, 5 different types of handwriting, blood spatters on it. It's like, yeah, this was one of the founders who wrote this, and
we dug this up from underneath the dinosaur.
Right. Pull it out of its guts after. And the other thing you want to gauge is honestly how much your players care. Because you can set up a whole bunch of stuff like this. I think as long as you keep it, so it doesn't take up too much screen time, so to speak, you'll probably be fine. But it also might be that it's like, well, we don't really care how we all got here. We have been here, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So the players may or may not have a big concern about that.
Thanks. Do you guys carry? Do you guys have your own GM notebooks and journals? And if you do, can you tell us a little bit about what's in it, how you organize it, what your thought process is about it?
I'm absolutely awful at taking notes, so I rely on my players a lot. I'll have like, oh God, this is what I wrote last session. This doesn't make any sense. And then you say at the start of the session, who wants to recap what happened last session?
Yeah. And then usually I shoot up my hand and look at all of my notes and my maps.
Yeah.
I tend to take some notes before the session and after the session, but rarely during, unless I'm ad-libbing something. So if they have lost interest and they've decided that they want to go and talk to all the peddlers wearing fancy hats at the marketplace, and I make the terrible mistake of naming one of them, I will write that down.
Yeah. The thing I always wish I have when I'm running something is I wish I'd written down what accent I used for some random NPC. It's like, oh, was this one Southern, or was it more like a... Oh, geez.
So I don't take super extensive notes. I tend to take more notes when I'm a player. In part because that's how I remember things that I wasn't integral in like making, and it's also because I tend to be the party secretary in that regard and cartographer.
So as a player, usually I'm the type that I want to earn the win. I need to prove myself. But when I GM, half the party is like me, the other half wants to be Neo from The Matrix in the lobby scene. We're the PCs, we walk in and win. So how do you span the gap?
Do a little bit of both. Sometimes you need to... When you have a really diverse group of people with diverse interests, you give each one of them a little bit of time in their respective spotlight. And if you're so lucky as to have only 2 styles of play in your group...
Congratulations. Oh, okay. Well,
because the other ones are on their phones and not really paying attention to the
rascals. But yeah, so you can give them a couple of, you know, challenging. Actually, give them a couple of pushover fights. The ones who really want to just be little living demigods can feel really great about the whole thing. And then three combats in. Oh wait, but there's more.
Right. And you can do the fight that's both. Here's the big bad boss, and here are a whole bunch of chumps. And if you want to be the person taking out the chumps, you can take out like four chumps around. And if you want to be the one really going for it and trying to hit that boss, you can do that as well. So you kind of have something for both camps to do, particularly for kind of your set piece encounters and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The green shirt.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so I tend to bring in new players into games a great deal. I do have the occasional experienced player, but what I've run into is that during character creation, you know, you don't want to overwhelm new players. You don't want to give them, you know, a bajillion archetypes, and I honestly think the archetypes is one of the biggest strengths that Pathfinder has, but you don't want to just, like, smother them in all these options. And so what I've been doing is I've been basically, you know, they'll make their character, you know, the vanilla flavor of whatever class they're playing. But then I'll introduce him, like, you know, somebody from a particular society or something like that, and then use the retraining rules and basically let them retrain into an archetype without actually charging them money because, you know, they didn't have the option during character creation. The problem with this is of course, that puts in an awful lot of extra work for me because I'm making NPCs with, you know, various archetypes instead of just pulling somebody out of the NPC codex or something along those lines. So having the experience that you guys have, do you see a better way of easing in things like archetypes?
I think that's a really good way to do it. I would just not bother making the full character.
Yeah, I would just add
just kind of cheat and just be like, look at somebody in the NPC codex for your bonuses, and then just use the ability written in the archetype.
And even if they're going to be rolling dice in the vicinity of each other at any given time.
Right.
I mean, you can totally have a trainer or mentor character who never...
You don't know what their level is, so you don't know... Yeah,
exactly.
In character, you don't know their level, you don't know their bonus, so if they succeeded on an 8, you're like, sure, probably they can do that.
And another thing that you can do with that, especially for a let's-see-what-the-options-are perspective, is you can use trainers and mentors like that as a form of treasure, where it's not so much I'm going to give you 1,000 gold pieces to do this thing and rescue the princess, but rather, if you do this thing, I will totally show you my awesome technique. And then what you do is you give them furious focus from the APG for a month of in-game time because they have learned this cool technique. If they want to later on take that feat permanently, maybe they go back to that person. They're like, wow, I really like how you can cut things in just one swing. And they're like, that's only the beginning. Let me tell you about prestige classes. but you can let them sample and dabble like that because they're only getting loner options.
And you can do that with items as well. It's like, well, here's your dueling sword. You can, you have this on probation.
Uh-huh.
You have to come back to me and see if you've done well.
What if I don't? Oh, the last one who didn't return things to me got to be introduced to the other bits of my arsenal.
There's a lot of us, and we talk.
We talk. Some of us may have died. Some of us may have been crushed by T-Rexes. But
cool, thank you.
You sell that?
So a problem I've run into, I've run some evil campaigns, which I've gotten some amazing advice on those, and those have done well because I have had friends who've run them, and they say give them a main thing and a reason why they shouldn't kill each other. And that's worked amazingly. However, when I give it more free world and kind of don't care about alignment, my players just kind of go off torturing and pillaging, and it turns into the towns against them. And honestly, it's just boring for me. And it's not a game I'm invested in or enjoy anymore. And they don't care about the politics of the wars that are happening. They just want to talk about the awful things they're doing. And it's no longer fun for me. And it's turned into this point where players like that I just don't play with anymore. And I don't know if there's something maybe I can do or a technique I could play to make it more interesting on both sides.
So, and just to be clear, some of them you don't play with anymore, it's entirely fine to fire your players if you have to, right?
Yeah, I've learned that the hard way.
Yeah, if you or other people in the group have ceased having fun, it is okay to excise players in your group. It's, you know, not the first option, but it always is an option.
And going back to that whole consequences thing, You can show them that, you know, their torturing and murdering and pillaging comes with consequences. The one college game that I ran started with them working for an employer. They decided before the adventure really even began that they didn't like their employer. In fact, they were pretty sure that he was going to turn on them at some point. And so they murdered him. They threw him in a ditch. They never went into the first dungeon. They started heading north, thinking they were going to find some other adventure. The adventures they end up finding, and the basis of the entire campaign, is they were outlaws from the very beginning because they trashed everything they came across. People would stop and be like, hang on, we think we've heard of somebody by your description. Bam, 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 bam. And suddenly the PCs would roll initiative. And it was kind of amusing early on. And then eventually they realized just how many enemies they made, and it became a whole thing about taking out the biggest of these enemies, and then we just called it there. So if they're doing terrible things, you can kind of contextually show them that they are terrible people because paladins keep on showing up.
It has become an evil campaign at that point.
Yeah.
And treat it like any other evil campaign.
And one other thing that you can do to really turn things on them is if they cross the line just a little bit too far, you can say, okay, that was an awesome session out at the end of it. We're going to take a short break before we go on to the next session. And then in between those sessions, you send them the design notes or the campaign notes for the parallel campaign you're going to run, in which they have to play characters of a certain style whose main mission is kicking the tar out of the first group.
Ooh. That's cool. I like that.
And that way they get to really deal with the consequences of everything they've done, especially when Group A keeps on doing things to entirely dick over their new group. Behind the scenes. So it's like, well, I do this because my mother says that I sure was a bright young student who'd be a great sorcerer one day. Your mother's dead. Group A did it. I'm being a little dark and salty, but...
It's Gen Con.
I think this is a problem you've run into.
Oh, yeah.
No, thank you. That's great. Okay. I'm running a campaign where I've got 4 players, 2 women and 2 men. One of the ladies is kind of timid of not outgoing enough with the way she plays. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys tends to bully and push her into the ways he wants things to go, which caused me to put a hiatus on the campaign for several months. They pissed me off really bad.
Yeah.
I forced them into an evil campaign after that. Saying, if you're going to play evil, then here we go. But anyway, I'm wanting to know what is the best way to handle this, because he tries it on me, too. Mm-hmm. But
the first thing I would do is have a straight-up conversation with him and just say, this behavior is a problem. It's making the game less fun for other players. It's making the game less fun for me. If you can't curtail it, I will curtail it for you. I don't want to have to do that. But this is making the game worse. And if this is how you have fun, you can't have fun with us.
I tend to take subtle action first, and then I have that straight-up conversation. Because I run into this a fair amount in organized play, or did when I was doing a lot of like convention GMing. And it especially seemed to come up, stereotypically or not, with husband-wife teams, where it seemed like one was tagging along to just participate as a couple. And sometimes it was, oh, one of them is clearly playing 2 characters. At which point I would sort of intercede both in-game and out and be like, no, what does person 2 really want to do? Or an NPC would not want to talk to person 1, would ask person 2, is like, well, I've heard the story from here. You seem like an honest person, though. Tell me what you think. Well, she thinks, no, not again. What do you think? And you can try and draw them out a little bit, so that way you can equalize things some.
Right.
And if that doesn't work, then what Logan said.
Yeah, it came to a head on a point where what he was pushing for did not go with her alignment and mm-hmm. being I think she's a paladin.
Mm.
And I was shouting at him, shut up and let her decide what she wants mm-hmm. to do.
I mean, at that point, at the very least, have him step out of the room. It's like, you need to go outside, get some air, come back in 15 minutes, and he can then find out what has happened in his absence. And just kind of set the precedent that it's like, if this happens, we need to remove you from the situation. And if it, you know, if it happens more than once, I would ask him to leave the group.
Well, we gave him at his house.
So oh, it's a problem. And it's hard to kick him outside if he's at his own house.
Yeah. And there's even the in-game possibility of temporarily splitting the party and making sure those two are not together. That way, the more timid person has more of a chance to grow and experience playing this game without that other person lording over the first.
And it could even be an option to kind of get her comfort level up a little higher, to do like a solo session or a smaller session with like her and one other player that you think would get along better and kind of do, well, here's a side story because you got split off into this other passage. Here's what happened during this time. And you kind of do actual separate sessions with your two groups and then have them meet back up.
Solo sessions are so great for character development and for training people who aren't sure on the mechanics of their class.
Yeah,
it's just wonderful for that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with people trying to diplomacy but going in the exact opposite direction? Like a noble character who's trying to say, oh, the nobles are so great because of this, because I had such a good education, you should listen to me. And the other person they're trying to convince is a freedom fighter who grew up on the streets and is like, yeah, no, you're crap.
I think that one of the things to do there is to wait on the roll. So give a couple of volleys back and forth in conversation before they're rolling anything. That way you can both show through context clues and speech that this might not be the best route, but also you give them a chance to course correct.
Yeah. And eventually if you get to the end, it's like, okay, so you've said all this to this freedom fighter. So do you want that to be an intimidate check because you're trying to lord it over them, or do you want it to be a bluff check because you're trying to convince them the nobles are better than common?
What do you mean? I wanted it to be a diplomacy check.
Well, you that ship sailed.
or even, depending upon how permissive you want to be, well, if that's what you're aiming for, you might want to re-examine your argument.
Yeah. Do you want to rewind and say that again?
Yeah.
To make it more diplomatic?
Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm taking over this panel.
No problem.
So, Chandra brought up, I had a really good question with the timid players thing. That's something I've run into a lot, especially with people with new players, and they look at all the Kaiser rules before I've gotten a chance to guide them through, and they get overwhelmed. Like, no, I wish players would wait until I got to them. But I've tried to encourage with the role playing or the combat and really try to get them more involved, and they're still just. I think they get so caught up in the numbers.
Yeah.
They don't get into the game.
Yeah, I think one thing you can do is kind of say, okay, turn your character sheet over. Just tell me what you're trying to do.
Ooh, that's good.
And then when we get to the point where that requires a roll, I'll have you turn it over, look up your number, and make the roll. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of put all the numbers out of their head. Because I've had the same thing. Somebody's like, oh, I'm talking to this bartender. I'm going to try to sleight of hand? Right, and you want to kind of cut that kind of... kind of get the causality moving in the right direction, where
right.
It is the character action then to the mechanics rather than trying to fit the mechanics into whatever they're doing.
I think it's a good idea.
And it can be a little hit or miss with completely new players, but a classic twist campaign is the Amnesiac campaign, where you give them a blank character sheet and you start the story, and the moment that they would need to roll any dice, you tell them what number to put in there. Because you secretly have their characters built or what have you. It's like, I'm going to try and jump over this thing. Great. You have a -3. They're like, what do you mean? Flip over to your equipment. Right in full plate armor. You know, that sort of thing. So that way they can learn one piece at a time what their character is about. And after you do that for like 2 sessions or something, okay, by now they have a better feel for how the game itself works. If you want to continue that campaign, great.
Yeah, the only danger there is if you also have the experienced player who's like, okay, I attempt to climb that tree and then I attempt to cross that river and then I'm going to talk to that guy and try to get a better deal on this.
I'm
going to
use all 30 skill checks in 5 minutes.
I'm going to stealthily attempt to pick his pocket while also lying to him.
Yeah. In that case, they just get clubbed down by the guards or something like that. Yeah, so,
oh, how many hit points? Okay.
But that could be something to try.
I had seen the amnesiac idea somewhere online. I wasn't sure if it was anything someone had done successfully.
Usually it's brought up as something that's done for a more experienced group who then sort of have more of a social contract acceptance of this. But if somebody's being overwhelmed by the rules and are willing to give that a try, it can be pretty damn fun.
No, I think I'll try that when I get back home.
Any advice for getting more roleplay before dice rolls? Groups entering into a new area and instantly being the detect magic.
Yeah, I would just say if they say, detect magic is kind of a tricky one. But if they kind of say, all right, especially in like social situations where like, all right, I'm going to diplomacy this guy. Just say, all right, pick that die back up. Tell me what's happening. And then I will call for the role that's appropriate. And it can be tough sometimes, especially with experienced players, to get them to do that.
The comfort level for everybody for role playing is different. So for some people, once they've been cued to talk and have dialogue with the GM's characters, they'll just keep on going and really enjoy it. Some people, no matter how experienced, really would like to not speak in character or would really like to be done with the social thing fairly quickly. And at that point, it's sort of try to find a compromise in how much you're doing. And some people will just, you can't get them to speak in character, but you can at least tell them to summarize their argument. And at that point, maybe some other players at the table who really do like that sort of thing will jump in and say, well, maybe you could say it like this or something like that. Yeah. And that way you're serving several different people at once. But you won't make a loquacious actor out of everybody at your table.
And you can also, like in the situation of like detect magic or something, there are a couple things there. And one is that like if it's in a situation where there's a lot of stuff going on, right? And it's a market, and somebody's going to detect magic to look for magic items or whatever. You can kind of say, okay, you're detecting magic. That takes a little while. So while you're doing that, what are you doing, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of spread the spotlight around the table a little bit. But if it's in like a dungeon and it's like, okay, we enter this new room, and you describe the room, and they say, okay, we detect magic. Sometimes it's just they like having a routine and they like kind of knowing the best thing to do. Right. Okay, this is our procedure because that is the best way to go about this. It is we try to detect magic and then we attempt to search this, areas systematically. Sometimes it's like, yeah, that makes them feel smart because they have this routine, and sometimes that is entirely fine. It's kind of a nice little comfort blanket kind of part of the game.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I just kind of piggyback off of what he was talking about there. One of the things that I've always liked to do is try to incentivize the actual role play. So for like example, we had a bardish type character who actually wrote a dirty limerick for the group's fallen steed pack animal they had. And it was so impressive that I actually like gave him a little bonus on the next couple rolls in the next campaign session or whatever. But the problem I run into with that is that if I kind of incentivize like going that extra mile, then the group starts going the extra mile all the time, expecting to be incentivized for it. So how do you convince them to do great things without expecting something in return?
I just give it to them, honestly. It's like, yeah, you keep doing this cool stuff. I'm going to keep giving you cool stuff. Okay. The main pitfall I would avoid is like, if they do this limerick and it's really popular, and it's like, okay, you get an extra X amount of XP, and nobody else did, right? I would say, like, the group gets extra XP, right? So it's kind of, it's more team-based is the only thing I would say on that. But, yeah, if they keep going above and beyond, then I see no problem with just, they're keeping their play at a high level, and that's great.
And you can, out of game, but at the table, sort of ask them, okay, is this sort of the standard that we're setting? Mm-hmm. And if they're like, yeah, we want to keep on doing this sort of stuff, it's like, great, fantastic. If they keep on pushing themselves, all well and good. And maybe if they start to lag behind, maybe that's where either something slightly negative starts to happen, or whether you start to re-examine whether this is the right tempo to be keeping.
Yeah, if you start sensing burnout, that's when you really have a problem.
Yep.
To kind of expand on this, if you're worried about over-incentivizing,
It's going to sound like that comparison, but tree training a dog. Slowly, you have to kind of wean them off, and you, like the bar to get something goes up, and you cut it off. You cut them off occasionally, slowly, but not regularly.
Right, and that can also go along with leveling, because you've kind of said, okay, you did this limerick, that was cool, and it worked out for you. Now you've gone up a couple levels. That's not going to cut it anymore, right? You're going to have to put on the most amazing play the city has ever seen, right? And it's going to be harder to get that advantage because the bar is being set higher, right? You were at a high school level, and now you're at a college level, and now you're at an Olympian level, and you kind of keep escalating that way.
Probably enough time for one or two more questions.
Going along with the role playing, we're going to be going back to the Carrion Crown, and I'm not sure which book it is, but it's where they're at the hunting lodge.
Okay.
And the NPCs are initially kind of snooty towards them because they primarily deal with high-end people coming in.
So the kind of scene that with an evil-leaning campaign is very dangerous?
Pardon?
If you have a kind of group that sometimes leans evil, that can be a very dangerous type of scene to
get into. Right. But it's not just that they are leaning towards that, even though their alignment doesn't say that, but that they get this snooty, cocky attitude that they treat everyone poorly, all the NPCs that they encounter. I'm just not sure how to deal with that.
I think so. There are several different ways of showing character, and it's like what they say, and what's said about them, among other things, and what they do. And so, what is said about them can be used to convey to the PCs that every time they do this, they're burning important bridges. It might not be immediate. You might even let them do this for a couple more sessions before finally there's a big payoff that then continues to have ripples. So you might look ahead a little bit in the adventure path and say, okay, then they will be meeting with these other people who will either say, oh, wow, you guys are a bunch of jerks, consequence. Or it could be, and I don't know Carrion Crown as well as I know other ones, it could be they run into somebody even more arrogantly obnoxious than they are and gets to serve as something of a mirror as they're like, wow, that guy is a complete arsehole.
And
wait!
Right. And you notice that nobody's hanging out with them or with you.
Yeah.
They all kind of look at you like you're together somehow.
Could be a lot of fun. Yes.
I have in my home campaign, my players sometimes like get focus, so they are like buffing each other and they are like a team for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to rush the dungeon in 10 minutes, so that door has to open in 5 seconds so I can move on and do 10 rounds in these 10 minutes. How do I not suggest that kind of behavior? How do I, the door is stuck, it takes 5 minutes to maybe open. The door's...
There's a phenomenon called the 15-minute adventuring day, where they will adventure for 15 minutes, and they're like, oh, well, all of our spells are out, we've used all of our resources, it's time to go to sleep for another 23 hours, apparently.
And there are a lot of tools to fight it, but even with the number you have, it can be really hard to keep it from being, like you said, repetitive. It's like, oh, well, you fought another enemy who dispels your buffs. What do you know, right?
Uh-huh.
You have another stuck door.
Yeah, and so having them encounter things outside of their comfort zone and, more importantly, their comfort time can be good. So they have adventured really hard for 10 minutes. They have a pile of treasure. They drag it outside. They're like, oh, is somebody going to be waiting to ambush us? No. An hour later, though, while they're camping and saying, wow, isn't it great that all of us could cast heroism 60 times each? Then enemies attack when they don't have 2 minutes to cast all of their buff spells.
And they've used up all their spells at once and didn't hold
them back. So it can kind of teach them to keep some things in reserve. Because otherwise, like, trying to fight it with an escalating arms race will only end in tears for most people.
And to some extent, it's just kind of endemic to the system, right? The system, like, this is how the spells work, and this is the advantage you can get out of it. So it can be pretty tough to do a whole lot about it, unfortunately.
And if they're really, really powerful for their level, then something that you could even experiment with a little bit is using some homebrew rules to adjust how the Pathfinder mechanics work, which we provide a game. Yeah. What you do with it is entirely your business.
For example, limited spell casting from Pathfinder Unchained kind of says you always use the minimum duration for your spells, right? So getting up in higher levels, those spells still just last a minute or whatever.
You could also... way back when there was a potion miscibility table, which was if you drink more than like two potions at a time, they start to interact in your digestive system and you might explode, turn blue, shrink, whatever. You could, again, this is something you would want to work out with your players ahead of time, but if they are very powerful at the game, you might all agree, let's try out this like magic miscibility thing where you can only have so many magic items active at a time. Or
one spell on each person.
Or one spell on each person, after which there's a chance with each extra spell something goes a little wrong.
Yeah, and we have like the
primal
spell
magic
blights.
Oh, and spell blights too, yeah.
That you can use in that circumstance. You could also, like, if this is kind of their go and hit hard and fast style, depending on what kind of game you're running, you can just say, all right, you're going to get one fight that's going to kick your ass, and that is going to be the fight. And then it is going to take you a day to recover, and you might not survive that fight, even with all your buffs. Right? If they're all about the hard charging, then it's like, no, you're not going to steamroll four fights in a row. You're going to meet an equally powerful opposition. And just kind of say, yeah, this is the type of campaign that this is gunning towards. So it's going to be a clash every time.
We're going to play Boss Monster the Pathfinder game. That's sure. That could be fun. All right. I think with that, to make sure that we have time for the next panel to come in, we're going to call it there.
Yep.
But thank you very much, and we'll be just outside.
Me.